Welcome to Music History Monday for March 25th, 2024. I'm Bob Greenberg, and the title for today's podcast is The Towering Inferno. If you haven't already, please consider joining me on my subscription site at patreon.com/robertgreenbergmusic, where I blog, vlog, podcast, pontificate, review, and bloviate 4 to 6 times a week. We mark the birth on March 25th, 1867, 157 years ago today, of the cellist and conductor Arturo Toscanini in the city of Parma in what was then the Kingdom of Italy. He died at the age of 89 on January 16th, 1957, at his home in the Riverdale section of the Bronx in New York City. Properly embalmed and, we trust, adequately chilled, his no doubt well-dressed corpse was shipped off to Milan, Italy, where he was entombed in the Cimitero Monumentale. His epitaph features his own words, words he spoke in 1926 after conducting the posthumous premiere of Giacomo Puccini's opera Turandot, which had been left unfinished at Puccini's death. Quote, "Here the opera ends, because at this point the maestro died." Unquote. What made Toscanini so special? Arturo Toscanini lived a long life, and he lived it to the hilt. Firmly in the public eye from the age of 19 in 1886 until his death in 1957, he traveled everywhere, seemed to have performed with everyone, and had more affairs than Hugh Hefner had bunnies. This is my subtle way of saying that even the most cursory examination of his life is far, far beyond the purview of a 2,300-word post. Consequently, we will focus today on the two aspects of Toscanini's career that made him special and that together created the Toscanini legend: his revolutionary, at the time, style of conducting, and his incendiary Vesuvian temper. In tomorrow's Dr. Bob Prescribes post, we will pick back up with Maestro Toscanini, first with his breakthrough performance on June 30th, 1886, when, as the principal cellist in a traveling opera company, he was called upon to conduct Aida in Rio de Janeiro in the middle of what amounted to an audience riot, and then with recordings made and tantrums thrown during his final gig with the NBC Symphony Orchestra in New York City. The first modern conductor. As a conductor, Toscanini was a literalist. At the time he broke in as a conductor in 1886 at the age of 19, by the way, to instant acclaim on the part of audiences and performers, conductors typically treated the scores they conducted as vehicles for their personal self-expression and self-aggrandizement. For those conductors, that meant milking every piece of music they performed for as much expressive Sturm und Drang and Schmerz und Angst as was possible. If such conducting meant constantly speeding up and slowing down in a manner not indicated in the score, so be it. If it meant exaggerating the dynamics, the louds and softs, so be it. If it meant playing movements at speeds vastly different from those indicated by the composer, so be it. And if it meant altering a composer's indicated instrumentation, yes, so be it as well. It was said that hearing Toscanini conduct a familiar work, be it an opera by Puccini or a symphony by Beethoven, was like seeing a familiar painting cleaned and restored. With centuries of grime stripped away, viewers could experience and revel in its original colors for the first time. According to George Zell, 1897 to 1970, the longtime music director of the Cleveland Orchestra, quote, Toscanini changed the whole concept of conducting in that he rectified many, many arbitrary procedures of a generation of conductors before him. He wiped out the arbitrariness of the romantic interpreters. He did away with the meretricious tricks and the thick encrustation of the interpretive nuances that had been piling up for decades, unquote. Toscanini was, literally, the first modern conductor, a conductor for whom divining a composer's own musical intentions through the score was all important. In 1926, Toscanini made the following observation about the first movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, the Eroica Symphony. Quote, some say this is Napoleon, some Mussolini. For me, it is simply Allegro con brio, unquote. Around 1930, the famed Dutch conductor Willem Mengelberg, 1871 to 1951, saw fit to give Toscanini some conducting advice. Toscanini would have none of it. Quote, talk, talk, talk. That was Mengelberg. He came to me and told me at great length the proper German way to conduct Beethoven's Coriolanus overture. He had got it, he said quite seriously, from a conductor who supposedly had got it straight from Beethoven. Bah! I told him I got it straight from Beethoven himself, from the score, unquote. Now, please, his literalism notwithstanding, this doesn't mean that Toscanini was nothing but a human metronome, a heartless technician. Nothing, nothing could be farther from the truth. He understood that the music he conducted must sing and soar. Quote, one is not a machine. Music must breathe, unquote. But he also understood that the music he conducted must sing and soar on its own terms, terms outlined in the composer's score, and not according to his personal interpretive desires. The New York Times music critic Harold Schoenberg, who heard Toscanini conduct hundreds of times, wrote, quote, a literalist he may have been, but not a blind purist. His phrases were long and aristocratic, his climaxes stupendous, his handling of melodic elements gracious and lyric. Above all, the feature that marked his conducting was intensity. There was a tensile quality that no other conductor could match, and even light music suddenly sounded sinewy and powerful when Toscanini conducted, unquote. The Towering Inferno. Toscanini's interpretive revolution did not take place without casualties, and those casualties were the musicians under his baton. Toscanini expected perfection from himself and perfection from his musicians, and he forced them to practice their parts, often for the first time in decades. Hours upon hours of rehearsal time was lavished on works instrumentalists were convinced they already knew, works they hadn't really rehearsed in years. Writing in The New Yorker in 2017, the journalist and critic David Denby observed that, quote, Toscanini's rehearsal methods were notorious. He was usually gentle with singers, particularly singers learning a new role. But with orchestras, he could be a terror, singling out individuals and sections, breaking batons, ripping his handkerchief, destroying his watch, throwing things and shouting in his hoarse voice, Pezzi di Samaro che siete perdio! Vergogna, Mati, vergogna! What a bunch of dunces you are, by God! Shame on you, you crazy idiots! Shame! Yeah, that's awful, and almost comic. But I would make an unfortunate but accurate observation. Had Toscanini been a conciliatory, patient, collegial conductor, and not a ruthless, even terrifying taskmaster, he probably would never have accomplished what he did when he did. The towering inferno. For someone who stood just barely over 5 feet tall, 1.53 meters, or 5'1/4", being identified with the word towering seems a bit much. But make no mistake about it, with his large leonine head and aristocratic bearing, Toscanini terrorized everyone in his endless search for perfection. His temper was legendary, his despotism unrivaled, and his moral code unbending. Parenthetically, I would tell you that in tomorrow's Dr. Bob Prescribes post, I will feature a number of Toscanini's outbursts recorded in the 1940s and 1950s. They are truly hair-raising. The stories of Toscanini's unbridled rage and his absolute refusal to do things any other way but his own are legion. And if his attitude cost him jobs or resulted in physical violence, these were the prices he was willing to pay. For example, Toscanini was appointed the principal conductor at Milan's famed Teatro La Scala in 1895, at the age of 28. During the final show of his 1902-1903 season, a performance of Verdi's Un ballo in maschera, the audience demanded that the tenor, Giovanni Zenatello, encore an aria. Toscanini outright refused to do the encore, and the audience, for its part, refused to quiet down until the aria was encored. So, Toscanini simply walked off the stage, out of La Scala, and resigned his position. His tenure with the Metropolitan Opera likewise ended on a dissonant note. He took over there in 1908 and remained for 7 seasons, until 1915, when he stomped out of the house in one of his titanic rages, never to return. An article in the periodical Musical America identified the issues this way, quote, "Some say, frankly, that while they admire his genius and consider him perhaps the greatest opera conductor in the world today, they would not particularly miss him, for the reason that his great talent and mastery of stage effects were offset by his frightful irritability and his habit of perpetually abusing the artists, chorus, and orchestra during rehearsals, and never losing the opportunity of hurling invective at the Met's general manager, Giulio Gatti Casazza, whenever he saw him, whether on stage or in the wings. The result, they said, was that by the end of the season, half the company was in a state of nervous collapse," unquote. Decades passed before the Met tried to get Toscanini to return. But for whatever insult he believed himself to have suffered at the hands of the Metropolitan Opera, and to this day, no one knows what it was, Toscanini was not prepared to either forgive or forget. His famous response on being invited back to the Metropolitan Opera stage, quote, "I will conduct on the ashes of the Metropolitan," unquote. As for the fascists, Toscanini outright refused to perform the Italian fascist national anthem, Giovinezza, before concert performances in Italy in the 1920s, at a time when all musicians were required to do so. For this crime against the state, Toscanini was physically assaulted, spat on in the streets, vilified in the fascist press, spied on by the fascist government, and for a time, forbidden to leave the country. In 1931, Toscanini had had enough, and he outright refused to ever again conduct in fascist Italy. Likewise, Toscanini made no secret of his loathing for Hitler and the Nazis. He was scheduled to conduct Richard Wagner's Parsifal at the Bayreuth Festival during the summer of 1933. But Hitler and his Nazis had come to power earlier that year, and Toscanini was appalled by what he saw happening in Germany. So he canceled his appearance, explaining that it was because of, quote, painful events which have wounded my feelings as a man and an artist, unquote. Despite receiving a personal letter from Adolf Hitler himself imploring him to appear at Bayreuth, Toscanini stuck to his guns and stayed away. In 1937, Joseph Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda declared Toscanini to be, quote, an enemy of the regime, unquote. In 1938, after the Nazi takeover of Austria, Toscanini likewise severed his long-standing ties with the Salzburg Festival as well. So many anecdotes, so little time. The literature is filled to brimming with Toscanini stories, stories that shed tremendous light on who he was. Here are four of them, with the understanding that we will return to the maestro in tomorrow's Dr. Bob Prescribes post, there to continue our examination of this fascinating man and musician. We pick back up with Toscanini's refusal to appear at the 1933 Bayreuth Festival. In his book, Opera Off Stage, Walker and Company, 1996, Milton Brenner tells us that after Toscanini declined to appear at Bayreuth, quote, his place at the festival, at the urgent request of Wagner's daughter-in-law, the festival's director, was taken by Richard Strauss. This was the 50th anniversary of the death of Wagner, whom Strauss revered above all others, and for Strauss, the political situation was secondary. Shortly thereafter, Toscanini met Strauss in Milan and greeted him with the stinging remark, quote, as a musician, I take my hat off to you. As a man, I put it on again, unquote. Ethan Morden tells us this story in his book, Opera Anecdotes, Oxford University Press, 1985. Quote, at Salzburg, Toscanini was sitting in on Bruno Walter's rehearsal of Tristan and Isolde with Margarita Wallmann, who choreographed all Salzburg Festival performances in the pre-Nazi early 1930s. During the very long love duet in Act II, Maestro Toscanini turned to Wallmann and noted, if they were Italians, they would already have seven children. But see, they're Germans. They're still talking about it, unquote. Technically, of course, Toscanini was wrong. Isolde is Irish, and Tristan is English. But Wagner was German, so we'll cede Toscanini his point. In the Book of Musical Anecdotes, Free Press, 1985, Norman LeBrecht writes, quote, just before a concert, Toscanini paced up and down in the cellist Gregor Piatigorsky's dressing room, grunting, swearing to himself, and muttering to the cellist who was warming up, you are no good! I am no good! Piatigorsky stopped practicing and begged him to desist. Please, maestro, I will be a complete wreck! Toscanini departed to begin the concert. After a short overture, While waiting in the wings with Piatigorsky before the concerto, he repeated, "We are no good, but the orchestra is worse. Come on, my dear, let's go." Unquote. One more, for now. In 1937, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, created an orchestra exclusively for Toscanini. The language barrier between the Italian-born Toscanini and the New York-based musicians made for some interesting repartee. On one occasion, Toscanini aimed a temper tantrum at a clarinetist who had played a wrong note. The clarinetist, clearly fed up, fired an insult back, and Toscanini ordered him off the stage. As he left, the clarinetist turned around and shouted in colloquial New Yorkese, "Nuts to you!" To which Toscanini screamed back in his thick Italian accent, "It's too late to apologize." Unquote. Until tomorrow. Thank you. To sample and download one or all of my many courses on subjects musical produced by The Great Courses / The Teaching Company, please visit my website at robertgreenbergmusic.com.